gone all over time, so I'll just end it there. Thank you.
Shira Newman, the youngest member of the panel, was also a volunteer with the International Solidarity Movement, was in Palestine during the summer of 2002. She's a filmmaking student at Concordia University and works as a member of the Jewish Alliance Against the Occupation. She was raised in the Jewish community of Winnipeg. Sure.
Hi, and I'd like to also thank you all for being here. I'd like to say that, first of all, it's really good to be here in a Jewish center, actually getting to speak about these issues. Since I've become active in Middle East peace politics, particularly opposition to the occupation, I've been able to speak in bookstores, in sejeps, in universities, in churches, but I've never had the opportunity to speak in one of the institutions of my own community. I think that it's really exciting to be here. I think that it's extremely important that that Jews start to open up to the possibility of questioning the state of Israel and its policies. And I think that one of the things that happens to a lot of Jews who first start making attempts to do that is that they get called traitors, they get called anti-Semites, Jewish anti-Semites, they get called terrorist lovers, things like that. And people really are seriously silenced through that process, and meaningful debate is really hard to maintain. I should tell you that my first attempt to address some of these issues within my community happened about 2 years ago, when I actually first started to get involved in these issues and started to ask these questions. And it happened at a pro-Israel rally in Winnipeg, where me and some of my friends, Jewish friends, actually got together and, you know, put up together a pamphlet that just had a list of Israeli peace groups and their websites. And, you know, we made a banner that was in the colors of the Israeli flag that said, you know, Jews for a Just Peace and the Occupation. And, you know, some of us were Zionists, some were not, but we all really cared deeply about the fate of both Israelis and Palestinians and about the whole region. And we felt that, you know, unless we start to introduce the reality that, in fact, the reason for the violence, the source of the violence is the occupation, to end the violence, you end the occupation, and basic ideas like that, that we really weren't doing our work. And the reaction to that was so venomous that we were actually really surprised, because all of us were just starting to get involved in activism around this. And the reaction was, you know, by some members of the crowd, was to start yelling in our faces and, you know, say things like, you know, you would have thrown your own grandparents into the ovens and things like that. And to, you know, take our literature and rip it up and throw it on the ground, because somehow it was really threatening to have the websites of Israeli peace groups, and to cover us in Israeli flags so that our banner couldn't be seen and we couldn't see or be seen or speak. And it was, you know, it was really telling. It really informed me about the depth of fear and the depth of anger, and just how closed the community has become to any sort of meaningful dialogue around these issues. And I'm telling you all of this not because I'm like trying to present myself as some sort of victim, like in the light of the suffering that people are experiencing because of this occupation. This is obviously, you know, not terribly significant. But I guess I mention it just to explain how hard it has become to think freely within this community. And also, I guess when preparing for this talk, I kept thinking of all the other people that were at that rally, I'd forgotten about them. It was really a minority of people that wanted to absolutely silence us. And I think that those people are holding this community hostage. I think that there are a lot of people there that were there because it's what you do, because if you're a Jew, you know, if you don't want to support suicide bombings, if you hate anti-Semitism, if you act out of fear and you go and you join this sort of nationalistic rally. And, you know, there was awful flag waving going on there, and there was awful real hate mongering, I think, towards Palestinians and Arabs in general. But I don't think that is where the majority of the Jewish community is actually coming from. I actually believe that the majority of the Jewish community, if really made aware of the racism and the violence of the occupation, if able to look at it with clear eyes, unfettered by, you know, fear of either ostracism or of actual anti-Semitism, would be outraged by it and would be really disturbed by the fact that they had taken part in support for this. At that rally, I saw some friends and I saw some family members who were you know, there, and we never spoke about it again. They saw me, I saw them, we looked at each other, you know, and we never said a word about it after that. And we just kind of pretended it out of existence, as I think we've often just pretended the occupation out of existence. And now I think that the cost of our silence is just, it's too great. And I think that we need to start talking. And that's why I'm here, and I think that's why we're all here, because we think that we can't just ignore each other. We have to actually start talking about this within this community. When I was preparing, but when I was thinking about what I wanted to talk about for this presentation, I thought about showing a whole series of maps, because I think that one of the ways that we break through the mythology of the sort of very simplified nationalistic narrative of how Israel came into being and the idea of, you know, a land without a people for a people without a land, looking at maps is a really significant thing to do, starting with, you know, 1948. You can look at maps and see that Palestinian towns and villages existed that no longer existed. Where did they go? This is an important question, right? And I thought about showing that all the way to 1967, showing how Israeli policy, official policy from 1967 on, had the explicit intent of expropriating as much of the West Bank and Gaza as possible. And as Helga was talking about in relation to the wall, doing exactly what the wall is managing to do, which is taking as much land as possible without having to incorporate Palestinians into the state of Israel as full citizens. Okay, so I didn't do that because that's not where I started. And I'm hoping, I don't know, I'm not going to make assumptions about everyone who's in the audience, but I'm hoping that there are one or two people that are here that are just on the cusp, are Jewish people who are just starting to, you know, are starting to ask questions. And I guess that that because where I started breaking through that kind of mythology was much more personal than that, I would share that experience instead of heading straight to the maps and the charts. So I'm just going to tell a little bit about my own story, I guess. I grew up in, you know, a secular-ish, religious-ish, Zionist household. My parents are wonderful, decent people. They're social workers. They are anti-racist. They are, you know, believe in social justice. They've worked hard and long for a lot of important things within the Winnipeg community. And so that's one side of what I grew up with. And then the other side of the story was that I also grew up with a belief that, well, basically that Palestinians didn't exist, that Palestinians were made up. They were a creation of the of the people who hate Israel, of the people who hate Jews. They were a creation of the Arab world, which was created in order to destroy the state of Israel. And now I recognize that that is a way of distorting history that writes an entire people out of their own experience, that denies them any claim to the land on which they live, which denies them any claim to history. But that's what I grew up with. So somehow Palestinians were outside of the realm of the social justice, ideas of social justice, the ideas of human rights, you know, any of those things. It was never a question. The two had nothing to do with each other. When I was 19, I went to Israel to work on a kibbutz. I also had the sense that Helga is talking about, of pride in the idea of the kibbutzim, that they were, you know, bastions of sort of collective living and were wonderful progressive communities, which in fact on some levels they are. But I went there believing that somehow Israel was my rightful homeland, whether I had ever been there before, whether any of my relatives were there, which they weren't, or not. I believed that I had some kind of claim to that land, and I had a right to be there. And when we were taken on a tour through Israeli history, really there were no Palestinians existing in that history. Palestinians did not exist in that history. And I wonder sometimes how I could have ignored all these clues, right? I wonder sometimes how I could have, you know, ignored the fact that we were shown, we were taken to Arab villages that, you know, had gorgeous Arab architecture, and yet there were no Arabs there. You know, where did they go? That was a question I never thought to ask. But people were proud of the architecture. It's beautiful. It's a part of, you know, Israeli identity. So, but yet the question never gets asked. I never asked the questions, and that history was written out of that. And, you know, I remember actually having a friend on the kibbutz who was who had served in Gaza, and he was devastated by the things that he had seen there. He was a lovely person who was really traumatized when he talked about, you know, when he talked about atrocious things happening in Gaza. I don't even remember all that he said because, honestly, I didn't even hear it. You know, it's the kind of thing where you can absolutely close your consciousness to the things that are going on. And this was an Israeli soldier telling me these things. And I guess the only answer that I have to why I could become so closed, and why I think so many people can become so closed to hearing these kinds of things, you know, again and again and again, and seeing images and seeing, you know, watching CNN and seeing, you know, seeing terrible things happening within the occupied territories, is that I think that we're all products of our environment to a certain extent. And I really believe that people want to trust that the people that we trust tell us the truth, you know? It wasn't really, I guess, until many years later that I began to ask some of the really important questions. I guess people ask me a lot, how did you sort of make that transition? Like, you know, I was a hardcore Zionist. How did you stop being a hardcore Zionist? How did you start to ask these questions about Israel? And, I mean, there were so many keys to that. There are so many components. I've tried to think about it, like what a couple of those things are, so I could try and explain them. I don't know if this is everything or not, but I guess one thing was just becoming active in human rights work in general, and starting to meet people who were activists who had worked in, you know, against apartheid in South Africa, who had worked against the occupation of East Timor, you know, who worked against who worked against the oppression of the native community here, you know, people from each of these, from within each of these communities, and also people who were just supporters of those communities, and among those people who believed, you know, clearly in like universal human rights, who were clearly anti-racist, were a lot of people who talked about Palestine, a lot of people who talked about the occupation as something that was truly atrocious, and talked about the abuse of Palestinian human rights. And I was really resistant to hearing that. I remember getting really angry at people and thinking, oh no, the left really is full of anti-Semites. But, you know, at a certain point, you're working with these people, and they're wonderful people, and, you know, they are anti-racist on every level, and including opposed to anti-Semitism. And it just becomes clear that that is not the source of their opposition to the occupation. It is not, you know, a virulent hatred of Jews. It is something much, much deeper, and it relates to just their sense of the humanity of Palestinians, and a knowledge of the history of oppression there, and a knowledge of the way occupation has worked, not only there, but, you know, elsewhere as well, and the ability to analyze through that. Sorry, I think I'm going on a bit, but I guess the second thing that helped me to sort of shift, and I think this affected a lot of people, was the fact of the Oslo process, was that somehow Palestinians suddenly did exist. And I know that Helga, that Helga, I'm a little flustered. I know that Helga was talking about the Intifada, the first Intifada, being the thing that made her really aware that Palestinians existed. For me, I guess I was a bit too young for that. So it was the Oslo process. It was actually seeing that even the Israeli government recognized that Palestinians were there and actually had to be negotiated with, which obviously came through the Intifada. And then the fact that, you know, as much as they're corrupt and he's corrupt and I criticize him on so many levels, Arafat was willing to sign away 78% of Mandate Palestine. So that meant something. That meant, okay, not only do Palestinians exist, but they're not trying to throw the Jews into the sea. You know, what does that mean? And that was at the very beginning of the Oslo process. And from there, you know, recognizing that regular people on the street in Palestine were super supportive of this, and were that there really was like celebration on the street, not among everybody, but for various reasons. But you know, nobody can deny that there was a sense of real hope among Palestinians, that this was the beginning of the birth of a Palestinian sovereign state. Okay, so now we have Palestinians who simply want a sovereign state in 22% of the land. That's really different than the perspective that I had had before. I guess the third thing that really probably made the most dramatic shift in my perception of things, and made me actually want to go to Palestine, made me want to really engage with this, made me care a lot, were the images that were coming out of the occupied territories during the Second Intifada. There were images of such terrible things and such sort of dehumanization of Palestinian people by Israeli soldiers that I couldn't, you know, deny them, like images of, you know, a four-year-old crying with three guns pointed to his head. I mean, it's something that makes people really uncomfortable and defensive when I talk about this, but those images did remind me of the images that I grew up with of the Second World War and of the treatment of Jews, not because they were concentration camps and not because there's a process of extermination in the same way, but because you look at those images and you can't help but wonder, how can those soldiers be doing that unless they don't recognize that four-year-old as a human being, you know? And what else does that mean? Like, where else can that go? And I think there were also things being said around that time that I started to hear by Israeli officials and by people in the community, quite frankly, that were so devastating to me that went along with that kind of dehumanization. Like, hearing Israeli officials say things like, you know, Palestinians are a cancer, and what we need is chemotherapy. I mean, it was reminiscent of too much that I had learned, and too much that I had heard and learned about the oppression of Jews in Second World War, and I just felt like something absolutely had to be done, and I had to be a part of that. So I went to the West Bank. I joined the International Solidarity Movement, as Helga did, and I think she gave a really good description of what that movement is. I can maybe give a little bit more history about it. It was born out of an organization called the Center for Rapprochement Between Peoples, and that was an organization that existed during Oslo, which was Israelis and Palestinians meeting and getting to know each other and finding out about each other's lives and sort of building a basis for peace and dialogue. When the Second Intifada began and the military incursions began, the border has really been closed to Israelis coming into Palestine, into the West Bank. Israelis really don't get to see much of what's going on except for soldiers and settlers. Israelis are pretty much locked out of that knowledge. So they stopped. They were no longer able to do that, as well as the fact that, you know, now you have huge military presence and tremendous amounts of violence, and it starts to seem like the best thing you can do to build peace is, in fact, struggle against the occupation. And so it built into the International Solidarity Movement, which is, as Helga mentioned, is a Palestinian-led, Palestinian-organized movement, which is committed to promoting nonviolent direct action resistance in the occupied territories. And I just want to say, Palestinians have a tremendous history of nonviolent resistance. There's a huge mythology around that. But the reality is that the First Intifada was largely nonviolent, that strikes and protests were a huge part of the way that people resisted in a day-to-day way. And I think the thing that's happened and the reason why there's a need for an international presence is because that resistance is now almost continually met with tremendous violence. And whereas people could go out on the streets and demonstrate during the First Intifada, and though many Palestinians were killed, not nearly in the sort of numbers that they are now, now it's you're risking your life if you join a demonstration in, a West Bank town or city. And so the idea is to have internationals there because, as Helga said, that does seem to, or has at times, seemed to help to mitigate some of the violence involved in that. And I guess the other kind of, one of the forms of nonviolent resistance I think a lot of people would identify at this point is simply for Palestinians to continue to exist, is to stay there and to work and to eat and to go to school and, all of those sorts of things. So having internationals' presence and be involved in those day-to-day sort of things is really, really significant. One really interesting example of a Palestinian action of sort of nonviolent resistance that took place last year was in Nablus after curfew had been imposed for it was over 100 days. And for anyone who doesn't know what curfew is, basically under curfew, you are trapped in your home. You're not allowed to go outside. You're not allowed to do anything. Life basically stops. And so it was for 100 days, people had been pretty much locked in their own homes. Children weren't able to go to school, etc. And at a certain point, families decided that they were just going to open the schools. They were just going to do it. They were like, screw the curfew. Our children have to go to school. They're going insane. And they managed to open the schools. And how long have I been talking for?
A while. You should wrap it up if you can.
Oh, man, I barely got into anything that I wanted to talk about.
Well, there's a lot there.
Yeah, that's too bad.
We'll tease it out in questions.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm not going to tell you about anything that I experienced while I was there, because I don't have time to talk about that, apparently. I'll just say briefly that I was there during August of 2002, and it was a time that our media really says was like a period of calm and peace, because there were no suicide bombings during that time for quite a while. And I can tell you that that was no time of calm and peace. I mean, it was terrible. I was shocked. I was really stunned, even with all that I had read and, you know, and heard and watched in documentaries. I was completely overwhelmed by the amount of sort of malicious violence that was being directed towards Palestinians in terms of checkpoints, curfews, home demolitions, detentions, and in terms of, people were being killed every day that I was there, and still the media claimed that this was like a period of calm. I don't know what else to say about that. It was really shocking to me, but I don't have time to go into it. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm just gonna end with one thing, which is that I think with the creation of the wall, that I know that is going to be talked about more. I think that Jews have sort of. Are you going to be talking about the wall? No, I'm just saying a couple of words. I think the Jews are at a point where they have to make a decision about how they want to live in this world, and particularly the Jews of Israel. And the two choices are really, you know, Israel can either become a ghetto, which is exactly what it's turning itself into. It's surrounding itself with a wall. It's rejecting any sort of relationship with its neighbors. It's making sure that outside of its walls are, you know, are permanent enemies. It's continuing on the occupation while, you know, cloistering itself away behind, like, American military dollars. And that's, you know, that's one option, I suppose. And the other option does exist, which is to actually work towards disarmament of the Middle East, towards relationships with all of its neighbors by ending the occupation. It's been offered this. And actually starting to inhabit the world. And I think that that is not only the right thing to do, but is the way that Jews and anybody else in that region can start to work towards an actual safe and secure future for everybody, including themselves. And I'm just going to end with a quote from Asaf Oron, who, if I can find it, who is one of the Israeli military personnel that refused to serve in the West Bank and Gaza, that refused to support the occupation. This was from a while ago. He's joined by a huge number of people at this point. I think there's just under 1,300 Israeli refusers of different kinds. Some of them are high school students who are refusing to ever go into the military at all. Just recently, there were a series of pilots who had been flying missions over Gaza, and they refused to any longer drop bombs on the intensely populated areas of Gaza and potentially be killing huge numbers of civilians. And anyways, the Asaf Oron quote is, this is towards sort of the older generation. "What did you raise us on?" he asks of our parents' generation. "On the one hand, universal ethics and universal justice, peace, liberty, and equality to all. And on the other hand, the Arabs want to throw us into the sea. They are all crafty and primitive. You can't trust them." He goes on to say, "I was raised on two value systems. One was the ethical code and the other the tribal code. And I naively believed that the two could coexist." Anyways, I think that's something for us all to...